Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Be sure to check us out online at www.wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now enjoy this edition of the Midweek Podcast.
So tonight we are joined by Mr. Paul Kimball again. And welcome back, Paul.
Hi, Soraya. Good to be back. I can hear the teeth gnashing from some of your audience members after my previous appearances. What? The 9/11 debunker guy again? Oh, no. Alien abduction debunker guy again? What are they going to debunk this week? Well, what are we going to debunk this week?
This week we're going to take on Roswell.
Oh, wow. That's Roswell, the sort of WWE of ufology. And we planned that because we were talking about pro wrestling earlier. Yeah, you know, Roswell's the 500-pound gorilla of the UFO research community. So sure, why not?
And, one of the things I always point out is that you have something like Roswell, and people are always pointing to it, but you have something like the Rendlesham Forest incident, which seems to be something very genuine and very real, and it doesn't get anywhere near the attention that Roswell does.
Yeah, well, it depends on where you are. If you're in the United Kingdom, I think the Rendlesham case is probably better known than Roswell.
Really?
Yeah, because it's it happened in the United Kingdom, and it's more recent. Roswell, it's a very American thing. Well, it's everybody does it, but the Americans do it more than anyone else. Think that they're the center of the universe. It's kind of like before the Copernican Revolution. The entire world revolves around the United States. There's no question that Roswell, for good or ill, and we can talk about that, is a central, very important case, which doesn't mean it's real, but in terms of just how prevalent it is within ufology and within the broader culture, I mean, it's huge compared to other cases in the United States. And that bleeds over into Canada, and it bleeds over into Europe, and it bleeds over around the world. But in the United Kingdom, I don't know, I've never done a poll, but, you know, the Rendlesham case is pretty well known. It's been a lot of documentaries. It received a lot of newspaper coverage back when it happened, but also in years subsequent to that. If somebody hears a clicking, it's just, I have a cough drop, so it's just me finishing off my cough drop. Sorry about that. So yeah, Roswell is bigger around the world if you had to average it out. But, you know, the Rendlesham case is not overlooked. It was in my film. There you go, my film. Best Evidence, Top 10 UFO Sightings. Roswell wasn't in, and the Rendlesham case was, which clearly proves my point that Rendlesham is more important. I think more people would know Roswell than they would Rendlesham, but Rendlesham is not overlooked. If there's an overlooked case, it's probably the Shag Harbor UFO incident from 1967 here in Canada, which I would argue, whatever happened, has better witnesses, a better documentary trail. I mean, it's just a better case than either Rendlesham or Roswell.
Really? You think it's better than Rendlesham?
Yeah. I'm actually not a big fan of the Rendlesham case for a lot of reasons, not the least of which is when you like Roswell, what Rendlesham has is an awful lot of fluff. So when you start peeling away the layers, you find witnesses like Larry Warren, alleged witnesses like Larry Warren, and there are others, and their stories are markedly different than other people's stories. Some seem to go, off into weird new directions. Peniston and Burroughs, John Burroughs and Jim Peniston, two people who, even in 1980, said they had an experience, and I don't think anybody questions that something happened to them, whether they saw a lighthouse light or who knows, or a real alien spacecraft, doesn't matter, but they legitimately seem to have had something happen to them that spooked them at the time. But now they've got this new book coming out with Nick Pope, and they've been talking over the last few years, I think Burroughs in particular, maybe it's Peniston, I'm not sure, about receiving a binary code telepathically or whatever, and they're convinced it's time travelers trying to send a message, blah, 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 blah. And at that point, you just kind of go, huh, well, that sort of stretches credulity to the point where you look at their original testimony and go, well, how much of what these guys said can you actually believe, other than maybe the core account, which really doesn't seem particularly anonymous, but how much can you believe they walked up to a craft, they touched it? I don't know. So Roswell has that in spades too. Witnesses coming out of the woodwork to tell stories after it becomes popular. Witnesses who were, you know, there's nobody who doubts that Jesse Marcel found something in the desert. Fine. Nobody doubts that. Even the most ardent debunker wouldn't doubt that. The question is what he found. And so you look at Marcel, who served honorably in the American military. There's no debunker would question his actual career. But after the Roswell case comes to the fore, you know, Marcel's story constantly changes after that, as does Marcel's account of his own personal history. And he doesn't revise it downward. Nobody ever revises it downward. Nobody with a PhD just admits to a bachelor's degree. You don't go, oh, I have a bachelor's degree in science, when you actually have a PhD from MIT. It works the other way. If you just have a bachelor's degree from, you know, a local community college, and you might be tempted to try and lie and say, well, actually, you know, I got a PhD from MIT. Sounds like Phil Imbrogno, for folks who might know the Imbrogno scandal of a couple of years ago. So that kind of stuff is rampant. And Marcel is a prime example. You'll never hear Roswell proponents talk about this, ever. But Jesse Marcel repeatedly, I mean, normally I hesitate to use the word lie, but lied about his background once the Roswell story took off, especially in an interview he conducted, or was conducted with him by a reporter named Bob Pratt, who's now deceased. And records exist, Pratt's notes and everything of that interview. And here's all these claims that Marcel is making. For instance, just one, just going to go with one. He claimed that he had won 5 air medals in the Second World War. Wow. Well, that's pretty impressive. Truth is, he won 2. Now, let me tell you, winning 2 air medals, that's pretty impressive too. But if you actually won 2, why would you say 5? Right. Because you're exaggerating. So then, and I mean, I could give you example after, that's a relatively minor example. He claimed he had degrees or education from a particular university that he didn't actually have, and on and on and on. You never hear the Roswell, this is the core central witness. The one guy who was in the desert that actually supports the UFO case that the Roswell proponents look at and said, look, he actually saw the records, he touched the records, we talked to him. Great. So the whole case, frankly, the Roswell case, hinges on Jesse Marcel to a large degree. And if you look at Jesse Marcel and you can say, well, okay, wait, by the late 70s and into the early 80s when he was talking about Roswell, maybe his credibility wasn't all that good. Prone to exaggeration, wanted to be the center of attention, which is what people prone to exaggeration are all about. That calls into question the kinds of the testimony that he was giving, which was also changing all the time. So if that's your best witness, and if that's your best case for a crash flying saucer, then there's no court of law you could walk into, because you often hear ufologists, they don't want to talk about scientific standards. You know, as Carl Sagan would say, extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof. They don't want that. They talk about courtroom standards of evidence. And they don't even talk about the criminal standard, which is beyond a reasonable doubt. They like to bring it down to the civil standard, which is on the balance of probabilities, meaning it's more likely than not. 50% plus one. I look at the Roswell case. I look at the witnesses. I look at the testimony. And I put my legal mind to it. And I say, if I walked into a court with 12 objective jurors, there's no way I could convince them, even on the most minimal standard, which is the balance of probabilities, that it's more likely than not that an alien spacecraft crashed in the desert in New Mexico, because the evidence just isn't there. And so that's my take on Roswell. And it's kind of my take on Rendlesham, because the more you find these witnesses who seem to start spinning crazy stories and embellishing their original accounts, then you start to lose, the case starts to lose whatever credibility it might have had. The one case that I can think of where that hasn't happened is Shag Harbor. That's why I mentioned the Shag Harbor case, because the witness is there. I was at, there's a recent book by my friend Graham Sims called Impact to Contact. Graham Sims and Chris Stiles. Stiles was one of the two original researchers on the Shag case, along with Don Ledger. So they have a new book out, and the book launch was in Halifax about a month and a half ago. So I went, and they had the original witness, a guy named Laurie Wickens. So he is the Jesse Marcel of the Shag Harbor case. And Laurie Wickens gets up there with the two researchers and another witness who's come forward later, So I'm always wary of witnesses who wander in 20 years later and start right. telling a tale that seems too good to be true. So I ignore the other guy. But there's Laurie Wickens. There's no question. He was there that night. He and his friends saw something in the sky. They called the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. They made the initial report. Fine. And I had a chance to talk to him beforehand. He'd had a couple of drinks, but he was a very nice guy, you know, salt of the earth fisherman. Fine. You love witnesses like that. Honest, true, solid citizens. He gets up there. Somebody asks him from the audience, packed house, and they, because it's the Q&A, and they say, Mr. Wickens, what was it? And that sounds like a character out of The Hobbit, but Mr. Wickens, you know, what was it like to see something from another world? Did that change you? And he just looked at them. And I'm going to try and do a southwestern Nova Scotian accent here, which I'm going to fail miserably because I'm a city guy. I just looked and he said, bye, it didn't change my life at all, bye. And you know, it's like, what? Wait, you saw an alien spacecraft. How did that not change your life? I didn't see an alien spacecraft. And you could see Graham's face and Chris Dahl's face go, what? Uh-oh. He said, I'd tell you now what I told the RCMP that night, by. It was an aircraft crashing, you know, going down into water. That's what we all thought. Okay, great. So here we have the witness who actually saw it saying it wasn't space aliens. It wasn't a UFO. It was some form of aircraft. He actually went on to kind of say he thinks that the cover-up, because you know, some of the things that went on was because it might have been some secret military thing or whatever. Fine, I don't know. But he was convinced, the original witnesses were convinced it was an aircraft. Now, they might be as wrong. You know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. Debunkers will always say if UFO witnesses, well, great, they can observe something, but they can't interpret it. So if they observe something and then they say it's space aliens, well, that's no good, because they're not qualified to call it anything. They can just report what they saw. So the same thing is true of Wickens. He's qualified to tell what he saw, but his interpretation is just his opinion. Having said that, I found it really refreshing to find a guy that 40, what, wait, I was born in 67, so, right, 47 years later, it's easy math for me, 47 years later, still telling the exact same story. No embellishments, no, well, as I walked through the woods, guys, I ran into, like, Bigfoot kind of thing. Or, you know, little hobbit men. You know, tells the exact same story. No BS. And I thought, cool. And to their credit, Chris Stiles and Graham Sims, the two authors and researchers, said, look, we're not going to tell anyone what to say. Laurie has his opinions. That's fine. And then they go, we think there's a lot of other evidence that, you know, sort of contradicts what Laurie's conclusion is. And okay, fine, you can argue about that. But I just thought that to me is why the Shag case, there are witnesses, there are real reports, and there's not a whole lot of embellishment at the core case. There's some embellishment that's come on later. I have a very good friend sorry, I'm rattling on, and I'll stop after this little story, and you can talk for 10 minutes or whatever. But I have a very good friend who was would have been about 10 at the time of the Shag Harbor incident, and I'm trying to get him to write this up. He's in the film industry. In fact, he's one of the co-producers on my next feature film that we start shooting next week that I told you about. What happened with the Shag Harbor case is, Shag Harbor is about 3 hours is to drive away from Halifax, which is the main city here, down on the shore. So that's where it happened. But it was reported as flying over Halifax, Dartmouth, which is the city, before, and then heading on down towards Shag Harbor. So there were a lot of people in the city who saw this, including my friend, Ron. And I had never heard this. I had heard his story. I heard that they saw that he and some friends saw this. They were frightened by it. But I'd never heard what he told me just last week when we were out on a location scout. And he said, because the witnesses in Shag Harbor describe it as being silent, as I recall. I think they said it was a silent object in the air. And Ron said to me, it was this terrifying sound that he had never heard before and he has never heard since. And I think he might have used the word unearthly. You know, it was just something that he'd never heard. And that doesn't mean space alien. It just means...
Right.
Nothing that he can imagine coming from the earth. And I said, well, what do you make of that? And he said, well, I don't know. 47 years later, and it's still pretty creepy. So, you know, there's a lot to the Shag Harbor. That is one of those underrated cases. Who knows what it was, but it's really fun and interesting, and it hasn't been fully mined yet, as opposed to Roswell and Rendlesham, which have been fully mined, and I think found completely wanting. So it's time to move on to better cases, or at least cases that still have something to offer us, like I think the Shag Harbor case.
Yeah, well, I think Rendlesham, if you look at the core the core events that happened, the initial stuff that came out is interesting. The stuff since then obviously has been embellished, and who knows where that's going to go. As soon as people see dollar signs for something, it kind of ruins whatever's going on. But for people who aren't familiar, why don't you explain what happened in Shag Harbor? Because I'm guessing a lot of people listening don't know anything about this.
Sure. It's always good to talk about a case I like as opposed to sort of slam the ones that I don't like. So, yeah, be positive, not negative. Basically, 1967, Shag Harbor, as I said, is a small fishing community down on the South Shore. It's about 3 hours, 2.5, 3 hours from Halifax. And, Nova Scotia is like Maine. If you're familiar with a Stephen King novel or film, it's kind of like Maine. We're all East Coast and those craggy fishing communities. So it's very relatively isolated. Certainly in the late 60s, it was isolated. So it was October, and this made front page headlines in the papers here the next day. First started, people in Halifax and Dartmouth, which is the sister city across the harbor, like my friend Ron, saw this thing flying over the city. And then later on in the evening, folks down in Shag Harbor, starting with Lori Wickens and his friends, reported seeing something hovering over the harbor and then going into the harbor. And it was a light, bright light. It depends on who you talk to. They said it was orange or sort of mutating, rotating kind of colors. And then it went into the harbor where it sort of floated. And this isn't a harbor like a city harbor. This is sort of a fishing community harbor. There's not, it's not like there's thousands of people living on the shores. And so it kind of floated there for a while. And then I think, you check my film, it's case number 6 in the Best Evidence film. I think it submerged, it went under the water, but it left a yellowish foam kind of substance on the surface of the water. So they reported to the RCMP. They thought a plane had crashed into the harbor, and the RCMP investigated it. There were other people who saw this as well. And the conclusion, and this, Don Ledger and Chris Stiles point this out all the time, because it is interesting. Most UFO cases, the witnesses will say it was a UFO or space aliens or whatever, and the government will say, well, no, it was, we can explain this, there's a prosaic explanation. In the Shag Harbor case, it's the opposite. The witnesses said it was an airplane, and the government documents label it as a UFO. Literally label it as a UFO. It's right in the middle of the armed forces documents. Now,
that just means unidentified flying objects.
Sure.
So
it nowhere in the government documents or reports does it say space aliens from Zeta Reticuli.
Right.
But, researchers latch on to that and they go, wow, it's rare to find a government document that says, when you have witnesses saying one thing, well, this was a UFO. So that maybe ties in, and I think it does, into the fact that at the time the government didn't want to admit what it really was, which might have been a satellite, it might have been a secret military aircraft of some sort, because what you're in the middle of the Cold War, first of all, but what else was down on the shore, not that far from Shag Harbor, was a very secret military base at a place called Government Point, now Sandy Point. I know, I shot a film there because they turned it into a film studio after they decommissioned it. And what it was a tracking facility that the Canadian government leased out to the Americans as part of our sort of mutual defense arrangement to track Soviet submarines in the North Atlantic. So, because Nova Scotia is the perfect place to track Soviet submarines in the North Atlantic, that's why we're a convoy port in both World Wars, we're right there. So it was a place, even though Shag Harbor itself is just a fishing community, that particular area was a place where, with highly sensitive in 1967, military equipment, personnel, and all that sort of stuff. So part of the story that goes on from there, so there was the basic story, but after that, Don and Chris have discovered witnesses who all remain anonymous, which I trust Don and Chris. I think they're honest, good researchers. I consider them both friends. Doesn't mean I believe what people, people tell them stuff. Doesn't mean I believe they recount it correctly. I just don't necessarily believe what people are telling them. So all the witnesses that they've talked to They've run into witnesses who say there was a military task force that was off the coast of Government Point, you know, Canadian and American naval forces, because the UFO traveled from Shag Harbor up the coast to Government Point, to this off the shore of this secret military base, and just kind of sat there on the bottom of the ocean like it was monitoring it or whatever. So divers went down apparently, and they actually saw the craft, and I think there might be one anonymous diver who says they might have seen an alien. I don't know. But they definitely saw the craft. So that story goes. And then another craft came underwater, joined it. The two of them left the location, went to the Gulf of Maine, which is a, you know, a bit of a hoof off the coast of Maine, and then exited the water and flew off into space or the sky or wherever they flew off to. None of that. There is no witness that I know of to any of that stuff that is not anonymous, that has said, hey, my name is Bob whatever, I was a corporal in the Canadian military, you know, I was a petty seaman or whatever, a diver, I was there, I went down, I saw this. Now that doesn't mean, if somebody did that, that doesn't mean they're telling the truth, but at least then you could say, well, okay, we know who you are, we can check your records, all the stuff that we've done with Jesse Marcel and Charles Halt at Rendlesham and all these people, we know who they are. Here's the downside to Shag. We don't know who these people are after the initial incident, all these anonymous witnesses. So, you know, there's problems with Shag too, the secondary story where you get into the really weird stuff where they talk about, you know, ships under the water and another ship joining it. That's there's nothing really to back that up except anonymous witness testimony. But the stuff that actually happened in Shag Harbor, there's no question that something went down. There's no question that people here in Halifax saw something go over the city. That case, there are a lot of moving parts, and I think there's still, you know, some research that can be done there. And unlike Roswell, it's still not that old a case. Most of these people that were around back then are still around. They're older. Wickens was, I think, 18 then, so now he's 65 or 66, but he's still alive and sound of mind. Whereas Roswell, they're all dead. Or right. If they're not dead, they might as well be because they're in their 80s or 90s. And Rendlesham, they're all still alive. But Rendlesham's just a colossal mess. I mean, if you're a UFO as a space alien proponent or whatever, Rendlesham has so many witnesses that have said so many weird things that don't match up with what they said before, and so many sort of competing claims, and some of the things like, you know, the trace, the radiation that they find. My friend Nick Pope trots this one out all the time. You know, Geiger counters were used by people who probably weren't trained to use Geiger counters, but let's move on. And they discovered radiation that was higher than normal. Well, if you go to a good place to look at the Rendlesham case, go to Ian Ridpath, R-I-D-P-A-T-H. Google his name, Google Rendlesham at the same time, and it'll take you to his website. David Clark, a researcher in the UK, is another one. I'm not saying these people are right, but they will offer the debunking side of the Rendlesham case, where they'll give you the what they say is the explanation, that they really did see the Orford Ness Lighthouse coming through the forest. I've been in Rendlesham Forest. Now, there was a hurricane between then and when I got there, so it looks remarkably, you know, it doesn't look the same anymore. A lot of trees went down and stuff. Mm. But, you know, Rendlesham Forest is just a creepy place. And there's a long history, like a lot of British forests, of creepy stories and strange things, most of which can, you know, be explained. And when you're out there at night, and I was, you get a little weirded out even today just by being out there. And so the mind can play tricks on people. People can see things that they think they see, but maybe they, you know, they think it's something else. If you listen to the tape, Charles Halt, the deputy base commander, made a tape. And here's something else about Rendlesham. So if, leaving aside every other witness, here's the deputy base commander. If you talk to Halt today, and I have, it seems like a seminal event in his life. Like this was it. This was a big thing. This was huge. Because he talks a lot about it, because it gets him on television and he gets a lot of trips out of it. But at the time, he went out, took a look, recorded his little tape, because he took a tape recorder with him, recorded, hey, this is weird, look at those lights, what's going on? And then, meh, he didn't call, you know, there was no massive response, they didn't pull the entire base out. If you really thought you were being invaded by space aliens, or, you know, there was something really potentially dangerous or weird or something, you'd call back in for reinforcements. None of that happened. They just kept wandering through the forest. Oh, look, that's weird. Oh, look, this is weird. Huh, wonder what that is. And then he went back and he wrote up a report. Not, you know, 5 minutes later, kind of, and then it showed up on his commanding officer's desk and people discussed it, and then it kind of got shelved, and that was sort of it. And it was a news story, and then it kind of drifted away until it came back and people started talking about it more and more, and new witnesses, in quotation marks, start coming forward. And as you say, despite the fact that a lot of UFO proponents, UFOs as space aliens, I should say, proponents will say, well, there's not really a lot of money in this. Sure there is. For some people, you can make not a great living, but you can, it can supplement your income. Plus, you get the notoriety. You get to be on TV, and you get to travel, because a lot of these, Hall, don't want to pick on Charles Hall, but he's been to a lot of conferences, and, you know, he's not paying his own freight. I'd like to go to these conferences and have somebody pay for me to go and stay in a nice hotel and be the center of attention. And there are people that do that kind of thing, and you can find an awful lot of them in the UFO field. You can find them in other fields too. So when you look at, again, I kind of come back to the Shag Harbor case. You don't get any of that in Shag. Maybe the, having the anonymous witnesses is a good thing. They don't want the attention because, right. You know, I don't want to go to a conference. Laurie Wickens came up because he did the authors a favor, but he doesn't go around speaking at conferences. And it was only a 3-hour drive and he had a couple of free drinks and fine, Bob's your uncle. So, but these people are not traveling to the MUFON conference and all that sort of stuff. So maybe that makes Shag better, the fact that the witnesses post facto, you know, the witnesses that of the really crazy stuff are more or less anonymous, and the earlier witnesses generally don't spend all their time going to UFO conferences. Who knows? But when I look at Rendlesham, that's what I see. And now I see Peniston and Burroughs with Nick Pope, and I'm disappointed that if Nick, I haven't read the book, nobody's read the book, they're being very cagey about it, it's coming out soon. But if it really is centering on this binary code stuff and everything, then my only reaction would be, well, okay, where was this 20 years ago or 25 years ago or 30 years ago?
Yeah, didn't he claim to not even have written it down until recently?
Yeah, something like that. And, you know, you can also, okay, sure, I can spin this. I'm a lawyer. I can spin this any way I want. So I could say, well, Your Honor, what happened was the time travelers left a subliminal message in his mind to be activated at a later date or whatever, I don't know, because they're time travelers. They're sitting in 2274. They can do whatever they want.
Right.
So that's the explanation. And I mean, in for a penny, in for a pound. If you actually believe they ran into time travelers, well then, okay, anything makes sense after that, right? Because they're time, if you can travel through time, I'm pretty sure everything else probably seems pretty simple to you. Like,
See, when I look at Rendlesham, what I see is Earth-like type phenomena.
Sure, absolutely. Potential. Now, one of the things, and I don't believe this in the sense that I'm not convinced by it, but I would believe that it's possible, is that they might, meaning the United States military, might have been running some sort of psychological exercise to test the defenses of the base, where there were nuclear weapons stored, to test the readiness of the troops, because in the 80s, you know, the American military had not recovered from Vietnam. It wasn't the crack, world-beating, imperialistic fighting force that it is today. It was sort of, you know, had the reputation of a bunch of druggies and losers who couldn't get jobs in the real world because nobody wanted to join the military because the Vietnam thing was only 6 years, you know, removed 6 years from that.
Yeah.
So the American military then was a lot different than the American military is today. So yeah, maybe something was being done to them. That's possible. It might have been a combination of a number of things. You know, they could have seen something in the sky that was natural, or, you know, perhaps a man-made object that was falling from space. I think it might have been Ridpath who might have come up with that explanation, I think. Or maybe that's the Cosford incident. Sorry, I'm rambling now. But anyway, I don't see anything about it from the original accounts that you can get from listening to Halt's tape and the original written reports, except from Peniston and Burroughs, and I'll get to that in a second, that indicates space aliens. Peniston and Burroughs, and I can never remember which one it was that did the drawings. I think it was Burroughs. No, wait, I think it was Peniston. Whatever. Drew drawings of what he actually claimed to have seen and encountered in the forest, a craft-like thing, which is right. Not dissimilar to a lot of other cases. One very famous case in Canada the Stephen Michalak case in the late 1960s, a guy out in Manitoba who claimed to basically run across something that was more or less not dissimilar to what Penniston and Burroughs claimed to run across. Smallish, weird, couldn't explain what it was. And, there are a fair number of cases like that. And at some point, you can come up with one of two conclusions, I guess. Three conclusions, sorry. One, they're lying, so they're hoaxing. Meh. Two, they did run across something, but maybe it was some sort of military technology that they weren't aware of, because these guys, you know, they didn't have super top secret Uber clearance, so who knows? They're not aware of a lot of stuff they wouldn't be aware of. Or three, they really did run into space aliens or time travelers.
Or something else anomalous.
Right. But if they actually ran into a craft, it does indicate if it's not ours and they're not hoaxing, then it's got to be somebody else's, which means space aliens, time travelers, something, you know, truly, truly anomalous. Then you kind of have to step back, look at the entire range of evidence and say, well, okay, which one of those three conclusions is most likely? Which one of those three conclusions is the next most likely? And then which one of those three conclusions is the least likely to the point of, I don't buy it. And the space alien time traveling one is the one that is least likely that I don't buy. The one that is, I think, most likely is that it was just a confluence of events and mistaken impressions and all sorts of stuff getting mashed into a soup. Call it the fog of war, if you will, even though it wasn't a war, but call it the fog of running around in a forest in the middle of the night in December in the United Kingdom after a Christmas party, because that's basically what they were doing. And seeing some things and mistaking some things and who knows. So that's what I think is most likely. I think the next most likely thing is some form of military technology, perhaps a psyops operation to test the readiness. Maybe, you know, maybe. But I think that's less likely. And then the one that I discount, I really do, I discount the space alien time travelers, because I don't see anything there. I really do believe an extraordinary claim like that requires extraordinary evidence. And that extraordinary evidence doesn't exist. And you would think it would, especially for Rendlesham. Roswell, perhaps not so much, because it was out in the middle of nowhere 60-plus years ago. But for Rendlesham, you would think there would be a fairly significant amount of evidence, and certainly more witnesses and stuff, other than these guys in the forest claiming to have seen things. You would think that there would have been a lot of people all around, that, including civilians, in that area. Because there's a village. Woodbridge is not that far away. Because you take the train into Woodbridge and then you go up to the base, and I don't really know of anybody else except for these guys who reported seeing anything. But these lights were supposedly bright and in the sky and shining beams, laser-like beams, Halt told me, down to the ground. What, and nobody else saw that? Okay, maybe, but I don't buy it.
All right, fair enough.
But I'm the resident debunker on Where Did the Road Go?
But that's not to say that you're closed-minded to this stuff either.
No, closed-minded would be you hear the story and you just go, bah, there's nothing to it. I heard the story and I talked to the witnesses. I mean, I was making a film in the case of Rendlesham, but I read the documents. I listened to Halt's tape. I canvassed all of the evidence. I weighed all of the evidence. And the conclusion that I came to is, not space aliens and not time travelers. There is a more prosaic explanation here. Probably. Now, would I ever rule out space aliens or time travelers? This is what makes me different than, you know, the true debunkers, I guess. No, I don't rule out the idea that maybe space aliens exist. I think they do. I think there are. I have no doubt there's other life in this universe, this galaxy. Most scientists would tell you the same thing. We're discovering exoplanets all the time, Earth-like planets, or at least planets that might be capable of life. And we found life on another planet, Mars, and water. So there you go. So I don't have any problem with thinking that there's life out there. I have a bigger problem thinking it's coming here, but I don't rule it out. It's possible. But then you get into the idea, well, okay, they're crashing their spacecraft everywhere, and they're abducting people and mutilating cows and putting on light shows like it's Burning Man for a few soldiers in the forest at Rendlesham. And I go, huh, they came all the way from here, from there to here, just to do that? Well, that seems odd.
Well, see, and I wouldn't say that extraterrestrials have anything to do with the UFO phenomenon. I would say we're looking at something else entirely.
you've read my book.
I have read your book.
I tend to agree with you without saying that I think that's an absolute certainty. I think whatever anomalous part there is to the UFO phenomenon, if there is one, is, and folks can go back and listen to the original show I did with you a year ago, I guess.
Yeah, ago, yeah.
Because I talk about it at much greater length. Whatever's behind it, if it is an advanced non-human intelligence, I think it's more likely that it's from here and it's been with us for a very long time, appearing in many different guises. And from the burning bush to Moses to dragons, maybe whatever in the Middle Ages, to UFOs, lights in the sky, that kind of stuff today. And that, you know, that I don't discount. I find that much more interesting and plausible. What I have come to discount, and I've looked at it for 10 years, more than 10 years now, is I discount the traditional space alien science fiction B-movie 1950s narrative that has them coming here in rickety spacecraft that crash everywhere, and they all seem to look like bug-eyed, bug-headed, green or gray monsters, and they're basically conducting B-level science experiments on us, using equipment, if you go to the alien abduction thing, that we wouldn't allow in a hospital anymore, much less advanced, super advanced space aliens. So yeah, there's nothing about that narrative. That entire narrative, which is part and parcel of what Roswell is and parts of what Rendlesham is, although now with the time traveler thing, that's a different angle. But that whole space alien narrative, I think, is played out. And that the only people who really buy that, not to say there aren't space aliens, not to say they haven't communicated with us, but the idea they're coming here in nuts and bolts spaceships, I think the boat has sailed on that one, or flown off planet, if you will. And people have been looking, starting with guys like Jacques Vallée many years ago, but others are looking for much more nuanced, complex, possible explanations that might involve an advanced non-human intelligence, or it might involve, you know, our own intelligence projecting itself in some way, but it much more interesting, much more complex, and frankly, I think much more probable than space aliens.
I would say Vallée and Keel are the ones who really started us off in that direction.
Keel did. I'm not a big fan of Keel. I think we talked about that too, because I sort of think Keel was more of a storyteller and story creator than he was a scientist. Obviously, he wasn't a scientist, but an accurate reporter of things. Even he admitted he made stuff up. But sure, I'll give him a little credit for coming up with some interesting ideas that more or less mirrored what Vallée was doing from a much more scientific perspective. Was well-grounded in science and was employing a methodology that, you know, Keel never bothered to employ. So,
I know Keel was sloppy on some stuff. I didn't realize he ever said he out and out made anything up.
Well, whether he actually ever said it or not, and I don't know. The truth is, I am familiar with Keel's work. I just don't like it. So my very good friend Greg Bishop is a big Keel fan. I think he has a lot of his books. I think he has an autographed book by him. And it's one of those things that Greg and I politely disagree about. I just don't have any time for Keel. He might have been a very good author. I don't find that kind of stuff interesting. I would much rather read people like Vallée or people who take it from they have a grounding. They're approaching it from a methodological point of view that I can relate to, which is serious, and they're conducting serious investigations or inquiries. And I don't think Keel was doing that. I think Keel was writing books and telling stories, and that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. I just don't think that's terribly useful. But having said that, he did, you know, he bandied about some good, some way out interesting ideas, whether he came up with them or he used somebody else's ideas. He was a popularizer of some of those ideas, so that's fine.
Oddly enough, when you mentioned the thing about people not knowing how to use Geiger counters, I just read of something he had written recently saying the exact same thing, that researchers need to actually learn how to use Geiger counters before they go into the field saying everything's radioactive.
Yeah. Well, I kind of agree with that to a point, but I also don't think researchers need to learn how to use Geiger counters, period. Yeah. They shouldn't be going out in the field with Geiger counters looking for radiation for a whole host of reasons. But I mean, maybe we talked about this too. It's hard to remember what we talked about a year ago, but I think my disdain for using equipment, the fake ghost hunter equipment, as I call it, like, and I used it when we were doing our show Ghost Cases. So we used it because I hated it. You don't really see me holding an EMF meter very much because I was a producer as well as a host and the director. So I kind of get to decide what I did and did not do. So you generally don't see me hanging out with the psychics. I left that to my co-host, Holly. Poor Holly. And you generally don't see me as the guy holding the EMF meter. I might be the guy making fun of the people holding the EMF meter, usually Holly. But I don't believe in any of that stuff. I don't think it's useful. I think it's the sort of fake ghost hunter UFO kind of stuff that people try and, who have no idea really of what science is, try and make themselves seem scientific. And there's a word for that. It's called pseudoscience. I think if you go with the idea that what we're dealing with here is not space aliens, it's not, you know, it's something much more amorphous, something much more intangible, then I think, frankly, all you have to do if that's it to encounter it is just to go out in the field, wherever the field is, could be a haunted house, could be a field where UFOs are reported, I don't know, whatever, and open yourself up to it. You don't need a Geiger counter. You take a camera. You know, if you want to take a camera, that's the best thing you can take. Because who knows, maybe you'll see something and take a picture. Fine. But other than that, everything else, I just think, you know, like, what is it? You know, the handheld tape recorders. Worst example. You're an audio guy. I'm an audio guy from my music career, but also in my film career. These people go into a Canadian Tire. Sorry, your American listenership. What do you get down there? Best Buy?
Okay. Yeah.
Radio Shack. Actually, Radio Shack's perfect. They go into a Radio Shack. They, you know, buy some $40 or $50 piece of equipment, in quotation marks, that they consider a tape recorder. And then they go out in the field and they record EVPs, as they call them, electronic voice prints or whatever the P is.
And they phenomena.
Think, phenomena. There they go. And you think, wow, this is my great-great-great-grandmother speaking to me from beyond the grave. No. It's, there's many things it could be, but your great-great-great-grandmother is probably not one of them. Because you're using a really lousy piece of equipment. And that's what they use. Now, even if you use a really, really good piece of equipment, even then, I go, you know, I just think if there are spirits from the great beyond, there are easier ways for them to contact you than to leave a message on a tape recorder. I mean, you know, so, and maybe they're, that kind of stuff just, it blows my mind. But it makes for, having done it when I was doing television, I guess, you know, that's the model. But when we did ghost cases, we did very little of that, and we tried to do much more of talking to witnesses and having the experience ourselves. So we would actually go into the place, sit down, and see if we could see anything or anything would happen to us. And sometimes it did. To me, that's what changed my view on, I don't consider them ghosts in the sense of spirits of the undead, but it changed my view on whatever that phenomena might be. It opened my mind to the possibility that maybe there is something there, because I actually had stuff happen that I couldn't explain. And I, believe me, folks listening probably have figured out by now, I try and explain it. And there's still stuff that happened when I was doing ghost cases a few years ago that I can't really explain, and I've tried. Doesn't mean that it was space aliens or anything anomalous. It just means I'm open to the possibility that it was, because I've exhausted what I can think of as being explanations. So anyway.
Well,
and we've spun wildly off topics.
So that's fine.
That's me.
Well, the thing about like EVPs and stuff, most EVPs, you listen back and they're like little distorted sounds. It could be a scratching on the microphone. It could be a defect of the recorder itself creating that. And they'll sort of enhance words into it. If you watch something like Ghost Adventures, when they play the EVP, they'll print on the screen what it's saying. And you can be like, oh, yeah, I can kind of hear that. But if you close your eyes, you don't hear it.
Right.
And every once in a while, though, I've met ghost hunters who have come up with crystal clear EVPs that defy any easy explanation. I mean, coming from an audio standpoint, there's no reason a clear voice should be on a recorder when there was absolute silence around them.
Yeah, I mean, I've never run across that. If these are people that you trust to not be liars, hoaxers, frauds, or whatever, that's the first step. Then, you know, maybe they genuinely found something interesting. I don't know. I've just never seen it. Now, in our show, we had a couple of things that happened that we included in the show. And to me, it was because they happened at a certain time. So you have to view everything in context. So if we got one episode, we got what sounded like a child saying no when Holly was walking away from a basement in a hotel where witnesses had reported seeing a child. And they had been doing some sort of seance, which I checked out of because I never wanted to be seen on television doing a seance. so I quickly checked out of that. But some sort of seance-y type thing, holding hands, chanting, whatever. And then they stopped. They finally, nothing happened. And as they were walking back upstairs, she didn't hear it. But you can, because we're professional television people, you can tell, you can sync, you know, the audio syncs. So when you're reviewing it weeks later, you go, right, when she was doing this, when she was there on the stairs, here's what her audio recorder was picking up because she left it on. And it was like, no. And she didn't leave it on purpose. She just forgot to turn it off. And there you go. So as she was leaving, it was like, no, almost like, don't go. That's what you might hear. But you might also just hear, what you might be hearing is some sort of anomaly, which is not paranormal or anything, that just, it's a coincidence. However, the entire context of that happening is at least interesting. So I know I said all EVPs, I don't think I said all, but the idea that the spirits from the great beyond would, you know, great aunt Myrtle is gonna contact you on a tape recorder, I don't believe that. I dismiss all of that out of hand. But if you are dealing with some form of advanced non-human intelligence that is interacting with us and putting a show on for us of some sort, I wouldn't dismiss the idea that, call the EVP the equivalent of the flute player in the Moody Blues. So it's the flute. And you know, every now and then there's a flute solo. So it's just another instrument in the repertoire that the advanced non-human intelligence uses to interact with us. Not to give us a message, but to, you know, just sort of, it's putting on a show for us. That I'm actually willing to at least consider. So those are in two different things. So when I dismiss EVPs, so I'm kind of backtracking, but I'm just I'm trying to make my position clear. I dismiss EVPs for what most so-called ghost hunters claim they are, which is the actual voice of the dead. What I don't completely dismiss them for is it something that is maybe pretending to be that, in the same way that characters in a horror film pretend to be that. We're just seeing part of a show. That I'm willing to consider. That's my perspective, which is not shared by very many people. So,
all right. Well, let me ask you this: in your documentary on UFOs, what was the number one best case?
The RB-47 case from 1957, which almost nobody outside of ufology has ever heard of.
I don't even think I've heard of it.
It would take a fairly long time to recount all the ins and outs, but the RB-47 was a highly technical American spy plane that you would have, I think it was two pilots and a navigator up in the cockpit, and then in the guts of the plane, sort of in the, you know, down below where you couldn't see out, you had three guys who were known as Ravens. They were electronic warfare officers. So these were highly trained crews, the creme de la creme of the American Air Force, and highly secret flights too. I've talked to some of these guys. Colonel Bruce Bailey, who flew in the RB-47s as a Raven, as one of these EMT warfare guys, is in my film. So, and had his own UFO sighting a couple years later, he didn't see it, he experienced it. Anyway, so a shakedown mission. They were shaking taking the plane out, basically to take it for a spin around the block to see, make sure everything was working. But it wasn't a training mission. The crew was as Bailey, who knew some of these guys and had trained under one or two of them, said these were the creme de la creme of the creme de la creme. So this was a top-notch crew. They're flying over the southern U.S. out of Oklahoma, I think. It's been a while since I've looked in the case. Down over Mississippi, Louisiana, Texas, Gulf of Mexico. And then they were on their way back, and I'm going to give it to you in a nutshell. The pilots and whoever was in the cockpit, the pilot, co-pilot, and I think it was a navigator, had a visual sighting of a bright light object that was following them. The crew, the electronic warfare guys who had radar and all that stuff inside the plane, picked it up. So it's like, great, we've pinged it. Ding, 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 there's something out there. Ground radar, military ground radar in Texas, picked it up. So now you've got three different really sources of information, of witnesses, whatever. It's kind of like the Holy Grail, the perfect storm of a UFO case. Eyewitnesses and two different streams of multiple electronic information coming in, confirming, seemingly confirming what the eyewitnesses said. And so this thing, they doubled back, and apparently this thing was kind of following them, blah, blah, blah. And I'm not doing it justice. RB47, UFO. Google that, and you'll see original reports by the UFO researcher, Dr. James McDonald, and subsequent reports by a guy named Brad Sparks and others, or you can see in my film. And Colonel Bruce Bailey, who was not in that RB-47, but had his own RB-47 case a few years later, talks about his case, but also talks about this case and this crew. So, and that's, you know, on the internet for free. Go to YouTube, Best Evidence, Top 10 UFO Sightings. You don't have to pay, you can just watch it. So that was the case that the UFO researchers voted as the number one case of all time, largely because it had all of that evidence that kind of, you know, it doesn't say crash space aliens, it doesn't even say space aliens, but it's an unsolved case that seems genuinely anomalous, that had quality witnesses and other data that was not witness related data or data. I just said both. There are people that have tried to explain that case. The one that I would direct your listeners to is a guy named Tim Printy. He has an online zine called Sunlight. If you Google Tim Printy, P-R-I-N-T-Y, and then Sunlight, S-U-N-L-I-T-E, you'll find his zine, go back about a year, and he devoted an entire issue, really, multiple pages, to trying to explain the RB-47 case, more or less because I challenged him to do it. Now, I challenged him to do it in private. The reason I challenged him was because we were corresponding. I said, all you do is write about Roswell. This was me trying to get a skeptic to stop talking about Roswell. It's bad enough that the believers talk about it. Why are you skeptics still talking about it? Move on. But he still blathers on about Roswell. They're like addicts. It's a circle. It's like the old Star Trek show where you had Lazarus and antimatter Lazarus, and they're always fighting and they could never get away from each other. Or Loki and the guy with the two painted faces. That's what Roswell, you know, debunkers and believers are like. They're locked in it's an event horizon of stupidity. So Printy's part of that because he's locked in the event horizon of stupidity of continually arguing about this one case. But every now and then he gets out of the event horizon before he sucks himself back in. And this RB-47 because I privately challenged him. I said, look, you should do something. Try the RB-47 case, do something different. And he did, to his credit, he did. I'm not sure I buy his explanation, but you know, he really put a lot of time into it, and his explanation, it's like what I said about the Rendlesham case, this sort of confluence of errors and prosaic things that all sort of added up to be explainable. And I can't do it justice, and I would urge folks to go look at both. Google the RB-47 case, watch my film, see what the believers say about it, and people who are relatively objective maybe sit in the middle and go, huh, this is weird, but they don't think it's space aliens necessarily. And then go read Printy's thing at his Sunlight website and see what he says about it, and then make up your own mind. And I, at the end of the day, despite the fact I sound like an arch debunker, that's what I encourage people to do. I mean, I'm only debunking because we're talking about things I don't believe in, and because I'm on a radio show where I presume you want my opinion for whatever it's worth.
Indeed.
But at the end of giving my opinion, I would always say to anyone else, maybe my opinion is more informed than most people's because I've actually looked into all of this, but that doesn't mean that you can't look into it too and become just as informed as I am. My opinion is worth more than yours if you haven't done that. Even if I'm wrong, it's still worth more than yours because you'll just be right by luck. But if you actually go out and do that kind of stuff, sure, then your opinion is as valid as mine and we can have a reasonable conversation. But so I encourage people to go out and look into the RB-47 case. And the Rendlesham, let me think, Rendlesham was number two, right? Or three. Oh. Yeah, Rendlesham was number two. And so you can see that case spelled out there. And the third case was the Tehran Iranian Air Force case from 1976.
Where the plane chased after the UFO?
Yes, and there were witnesses on the ground and some strange things that were reported to happen and some U.S. government reports that perhaps are not as secret as Stan Friedman would make them out to be, but still, they exist and found the case to be interesting. But none of the cases in my film, and I actually think a lot of the cases have been debunked, and there's nothing wrong with debunking a case. It's why I made the film, besides the fact the network was paying us. But I pitched it to them because I wanted to make a film and say, look, here's what the UFO experts say are the 10 best cases. Have at it. debunkers, disbelievers, skeptics, whatever you want to call yourself, go see what you can do with these. Stop talking about Roswell and talk about these cases. And if you can actually explain these ones, good for you. And the disbelievers always come, well, if we explain these 10, you'll just come up with 10 more. And my answer would be, unless I can find 10 more really, really good cases, no. I mean, if you can explain these 10, all 10, I'm
believably
fine. Yeah, I'm good. I'm in your camp at this point because you took their best shot and you explained them. And I think of the 10 cases, I did a post about 6 months ago on my Facebook page, and I think I said 6 of them, to my satisfaction, have been completely explained. 2 or 3 still seem, I'm not convinced. And 1 I still really like, although I don't think it's space aliens, and that would be Shag Harbor. Might be space aliens. I think that one is a case that still has a lot of meat on the bones. That whatever it was is still a very interesting case. I think the Tehran case is not fully explained, although they're moving in that direction, I think. The RB-47 has now has a competing explanation that you can match with the space alien answer, that you can match with those in the middle who go, we don't know, but it was weird. So that case is still, I think, of interest. And I still think Rendlesham is a little interesting, even though I kind of debunked it earlier. There's just so many problems with the binary code and everything that it's become. Yeah. And I think there is probably a prosaic explanation, but I don't completely rule out something weird. Oh, and the other one is the Kelly Johnson Santa Barbara Channel sighting from 1950. And my friend Lance Moody, who is I call him a disbeliever because it annoys him, I think, but you know, he's a skeptic. He's put forward an explanation for that. And if you Google Lance Moody and Kelly Johnson UFO, you can see that. And I'd encourage people to do that. Watch the story in my film. All the documents from the Kelly Johnson case are available online. This is a guy designed the SR-71 Blackbird, top aeronautical engineer, one of the top aeronautical engineers of the 20th century. Well familiar with top secret aircraft because he was making them. He was designing them. So he sees something from his home in Agoura, California, as he and his wife are looking out over the coast, over the ocean. At the same time, unbeknownst to him, as a crew of his top flight engineers and test pilots were flying a plane coming from the different direction, and they saw the same thing. Show up at work the next day, go, hey, did you know what I saw last night? What'd you see? I saw this. Really? We saw this more or less the same thing. Wow. And so the Air Force was very interested because they were working for Lockheed at the time. You know, they all filed reports. The reports can contain conflicting information. So it's, you kind of have to look and say, well, everybody sees things differently, right?
Right.
Any police officer will tell you that. You stand in front of 4 witnesses who all saw the same thing. They're all going to give you a slightly different story because everybody sees things differently. You pay attention to different things. And then the trick is to try and find out of that sort of a narrative that makes sense, that seems to be reasonable and fair based on all the maybe competing points of view. And that's where the argument begins, because Lance has one view of what that narrative is. Other people have a different view of what that narrative is. And I started off with a different view of that narrative. I went, I kind of buy the more non-skeptical view. I think something they really did see something really weird. I've moved more towards Lance's point of view without accepting it or adopting it, but going, you know what? The report, there are contradictions in the reports. Maybe what the believers do is they take the best case scenario. They pull everything out of the report that supports their claims, and then they kind of ignore all the stuff that maybe, And sometimes the skeptics do that too.
Now, I was going to say, the skeptics can do the same thing.
They can, but I think they do it less often, because most of them are not trying to put forward a worldview that says, space aliens are coming here. I think the believers are a little more dishonest, and not necessarily intentionally so. It might just be they're not doing it always on purpose. It's just they're trying to buttress subconsciously their own belief system, what they've come to believe. Mm-hmm. So it's like confirmation bias. You're naturally inclined to move towards the things that would support your own position, even if you're not doing it on purpose.
But I do think you have skeptics that do that exact thing because they disbelieve so heartily in this stuff that they're going to jump on any chance to dismiss it out of hand.
Sure, and they're not skeptics. They're disbelievers.
Right.
And that's the term I use. Lance is a disbeliever sometimes, but on other things, I think he's genuinely, he tries to be skeptical. I think most skeptics, most, are honest. I think a lot of believers are honest, although I think fewer than the skeptics. And, you know, but again, it's that yin-yang thing, or the Lazarus thing. The believers and the disbelievers at the end of the day are, you know, like James Randi on one side and Stephen Greer on the other side. And they're twin sides of the same coin. I think a pox on all their houses. Because in the middle, there are true skeptics. And, yeah, and they might veer. It's like being a centrist in politics. You might be center-left. You might be a little more left-wing. Or you might be center-right, a little more right-wing. But generally speaking, you're reasonable and you sit in the center. You're wishy-washy, as the people on the fringes would say. And that's fine. I think those are the people that should be running the country. It's the people on the far left and the far right. And I don't think Americans really understand what the far left is, but they certainly understand what the far right is. Right. Those are the people I have no real use for, because all they do is yell and scream, and they just want to win. And it's not about winning. It should be about finding the truth, right?
Yes.
I think so. So you can find those people, the truth seekers, in both sort of camps. But as far as my film goes, those are the four cases I still think are really interesting. RB47, Kelly Johnson, the Shag Harbor case, and Tehran, right. Yeah. And Rendlesham just barely hanging on. It's like being in the top 25 of the NCAA basketball thing. You know, it's like they're ranked 25th. And if they have one more loss, they're getting booted out of the tournament. They don't make the final 64. That's where Rendlesham is for me. It's a case that's on its last legs.
But now, you mentioned this other guy had a online zine. What's the difference between that and a blog?
He actually, I don't know what the difference is, I guess. I mean, it's a website, and it's like a lot of these, it's a magazine. He actually creates a magazine, so it's a PDF. You go there,
okay.
You click on the PDF, and it's a PDF, I call it a zine, which tells you how old I am, but it's a magazine, which is a zine. And, you know, it's an online version, an electronic version. PDF version. So yeah, it's a magazine.
Okay, all right, that's fair.
Yeah, it's not a blog like I used to run, where you know, yeah, different thing.
Okay, all right. It just struck me as a weird way of putting it, you know.
Yeah, sorry. Well, I'm old, and I'm out of the. I understand the zeitgeist, and I'm very tech savvy. But when I'm talking, it's like, it's a zine on the on the interwebby thing, which confuses me. Which isn't true. But
yeah. Oh, come on. We're almost the same age, so no excuses.
No, I know. I just like to play dumb.
So I guess to wrap all this up, we didn't really talk much about Roswell at all, but that's all right, I guess.
Probably for the best. But, you know, my summation on Roswell is there's nothing to Roswell. What the Air Force ultimately said it was, a MOGA balloon, that's what it was. And the idea that it was a crashed alien spacecraft, no, it wasn't. It wasn't a crashed alien spacecraft.
Well, you know what always struck me about Roswell? I mean, when I first got into to researching UFOs, of course, that was the big thing. And after a while, I got really cold about it, because it just seemed like the evidence wasn't there. Everything was circumstantial. Everything was. And the other thing is that, you know, it popped up when it happened, and then it disappeared. Mm-hmm. And you don't hear anything about Roswell till like the 80s, you know, 30 years later or so, before suddenly it's a big deal. And it's like, so why hasn't it been a big deal the whole time if a flying saucer really crashed?
Absolutely. And, you know, I'll leave your listeners with this. You know, and I really like Stan Friedman. I have to. He's related to me by marriage, not blood relatives. But I've always liked Stan. I think Stan's a really good guy. But he gave up his career in science, by and large, to become more or less a full-time UFO author, lecturer, whatever, proponent of the space alien theory in the late 60s, early 70s. You, at that point, your objectivity to some degree is compromised, because you now have a financial interest, because there's no career for Stan in saying there's no space aliens. That's not, you're not going to get invited to a whole lot of conferences. Nobody's going to give you a lot of book deals, whatever. That's just not going to happen. So I think Stan is genuinely honest, I think he's just come to believe things for, again, the confirmation bias stuff. So anyway, the whole UFO, but it's not just about Stan, the whole UFO field, if you will, the whole UFO story was really in the doldrums in the early 70s, mid-70s. The Condon Report had sucked all the energy out in the late 60s. The government had debunked it, mostly successfully, I think. You know, most of the UFO organizations like NICAP and APRO were relatively moribund or on their last legs. And the big, you know, the big era, the golden era of flying saucers was more or less over. It had been the 50s, the 60s, the Contactees, Donald Kehoe, Project Blue Book. All of that was gone, by and large. So, okay, well, what do you got? You've got a mythology, a subculture that is dying. And you have two choices. You can let it die, or you can inject something into it that it's like steroids. And you know what? I've never actually thought of it, but I was reading about Alex Rodriguez earlier today. So what is the crashed flying saucer meme? It is steroids for the UFO story, because that's what they injected into it in the 1970s. And boom, all of a sudden, it was bigger and better than ever, because along with it came conspiracies and, you know, all the X-Files stuff that showed up in the 90s comes out of Roswell and everything after that. I've called it Roswellism. And 100 space alien races, alien abductions, all that stuff happens after Roswell, really. And before that, the whole crashed alien spacecraft stuff, even the UFO believers like Donald Kehoe wanted nothing to do with it. They said, this is nuts. That they would come all the way here and then crash their ships everywhere. Crazy. And yet, somehow, they were so desperate in the 70s to find something to keep the business, if you will, going, that's what they latched onto. And they built an entire new mythology on it. And it's a wonderful achievement. I mean, from a sociological point of view, it's a tremendous achievement what they built. This whole story and all the different strands, they're modern bards.
Wasn't it more early 80s when the whole Roswell, wasn't it the MJ-12 document that kind of kicked everything going?
No. Stan encountered, you can hear about the first doc I ever did as a director was called Stanton T. Friedman Is Real for Canadian television. And it, again, is available for free online at YouTube. Our distributor has it up there. And it's actually on the Best Evidence DVD, too, as a bonus feature. You can see that for, get two for the price of one. And if you want to buy the DVD. And Stan tells a story, in the 70s, he was speaking, I think, somewhere in the South, and it might have been New Orleans, Louisiana, Mississippi, wherever. And a guy he was talking to at a radio station, he was doing an interview, said, oh, by the way, you're into all this UFO stuff. I got a buddy named Jesse Marcel, who's a ham radio operator. We're ham radio buddies. And he claims to have been a place called Roswell in the late 1940s when one of these things crashed. And as Stan tells the story, he went, Roswell? What's Roswell? Well, it wouldn't take you very long to find out what Roswell is. There were newspaper stories at the time. All you'd have to do is a basic newspaper story search. And eventually, Stan makes it sound a lot more mysterious than it is. Because the Roswell story in 1947, it came, Veni, Vidi, Vici. It came, it saw, and it didn't conquer. It disappeared overnight, virtually. And nobody thought anything more of it. And the big flying saucer story was the Aztec case, which allegedly happened the year after. That's the one that Frank Scully wrote a book called Behind the Flying Saucers on, a bestseller, hundreds of thousands of copies or whatever. And that was a complete and utter fraud, which, by the way, Stan now thinks is real. So Stan actually doesn't just think that Roswell is real. And he thinks there were two crashes at Roswell. I mean, the mind boggles. There were two crashes at Roswell, one in Corona outside Roswell and another one over on the plains of San Augustine, for which there is even less alleged evidence than the Roswell Corona crash. And Stan also buys the Aztec case. I think he buys, the Flatwoods Monster case. And these things are crashing everywhere. It's like they were built by the same people who built the East German Trabant cars or the Yugos. So apparently the space aliens could figure out how to fly between solar systems, but once you got there, not so much. So they skimped on the in-atmosphere flying things. And so but that's all part of building a myth, isn't it? So you create, it doesn't matter. Within the myth, you'll lose people. As you make it crazier and crazier, Stan's reputation has suffered, even amongst UFO believers. It's not what it used to be. And I regret that because I think he's a genuinely good man. And in his early days, he did very good work, whether you agree with it or not, more scientifically oriented work. He was a contemporary of Jim McDonald and Alan Hynek and Jacques Vallée back when they were all, Stan was a bit further out there, but they were all scientists looking at it scientifically. Roswell changed all of that. And ever since, Stan has got, you know, he still pushes the MJ-12 documents, despite the fact that virtually nobody else agrees with him, despite right. including UFO crashed spacecraft believers. So I'm not talking people like me. I'm talking about people who actually think Roswell is real, crashed alien spacecraft. And even they don't buy the MJ-12 documents. So, but that's the mythology that they've all created. And it's like different bards going from town to town. This bard comes to your town, tells a good story, wanders off to the next town. And then a week later, another bard comes in, Kevin Randall. And Kevin Randall tells the same general story, but he has different characters and he puts a different spin on it. And it's kind of a competing story to Stan Friedman's bardic story. And all the wizards and hobbits sit around and go, this is an interesting story too. Who do we believe? And, you know, that's kind of what they have. They're competing bards wandering from conference to conference and have been for over 30 years. Telling this Roswell myth, as far as I'm concerned.
All right.
So enough. See, we did talk about Roswell in the end. Just when your audience was starting to like me, and they're saying, "Hey, he just said maybe there is an advanced non-human intelligence." I ruined it. And 9/11 wasn't an inside job, people. So there you go. I'll leave you with that.
Well, you know what? Real quick on that, what do you think of the Freedom of Information Act that pulled up information that the Saudis might have been more involved?
Honestly, not familiar with it. So
okay.
My dad always told me, if you don't know what you're talking about, you have no knowledge of it, then don't offer an answer.
Hey.
If there is something out there that I haven't seen, I'd be interested. You know, send me a link. I'd be interested to read that. Although I consider 9/11 to not, I'm absolutely convinced, not an inside job. Whether the Saudis, I have no doubt that the Saudis had some contact, some definitely, even you know, the ardent, most ardent debunker will say, well, look where the terrorists came from.
Right.
So that wouldn't necessarily surprise me that some element of the Saudi regime, if you will, was involved at some point with the terrorists, because we know that some elements of the Saudi regime are involved with Al-Qaeda. So no surprise there. But what people have to realize is that you can't, it's not some monolithic entity. Do you know how many princes there are in Saudi Arabia?
Oh, sure.
Thousands. So when you say a prince in Saudi Arabia, you think, oh, that must be like, you know, a senator in the U.S. There's only 100 of them. No, actually, you know what? There's probably more princes in Saudi Arabia than not. Or that's not quite true, but there's an awful lot of princes in Saudi Arabia.
Right.
And so it's, you know, that's not necessarily, if that was the case, I'm just picking on the princes, but if people in the intelligence agencies were involved, sure, there's people in the Pakistani intelligence agency. For instance, it's one of the reasons why most Western governments generally don't trust the Pakistanis and consider them reliable allies, is because their own intelligence community is rifled with people who are Al-Qaeda supporters and have very closely. How do you think bin Laden managed to survive in Pakistan for so long? Because he was covered up for by the Pakistani elements within the Pakistani intelligence community and the military. But that doesn't mean all of the Pakistani spooks and army officers or whatever are in league with the bad guys. So it's a very complex and nuanced thing. But so I'm kind of spinning off on a tangent. But in terms of this Freedom of Information report you're talking about, I don't know what that is. And okay. I'd be, you know, send it along to me.
I'll send you a link.
I'd be happy to read it and see if it says anything that would convince me that maybe there was an inside 9/11.
Oh, I don't know conspiracy. If it necessarily points to an inside job, but it definitely makes the Saudis look a little bit more suspicious.
Can't imagine how that's possible, because I'm already suspicious. Highly suspicious of them. Anyway.
All right.
But yeah, well, sure, send it along.
Well, I thank you for talking with us. And you're working on a new movie?
I am, a science fiction sort of dramatic thriller called Roundabout, which we start shooting next Tuesday, which, because this will air later, Tuesday the 21st of January. I'll be done in the first week of March, and it should be out sometime towards the end of 2014. So that's very exciting.
Cool. What kind of release is it getting?
I have no idea. It might just be me and my mom and dad. But we do have a British distributor, a company called B7 Media. And at the very least, you know, it'll do the festival circuit. I did relatively low budget, and anything under, you know, a few million dollars is low budget. So this has a budget, it's just not over a few million dollars.
Right.
Anything in that league is not going to, probably not going to get a theatrical release of any real significance. So the market is, you know, television, and by television I mean things like Netflix or HBO, not HBO, the Sundance Channel in the US,
right,
the Movie Network here in Canada, whatever. And then, you know, Blu-ray and all that sort of stuff. So that,
cool.
And it'll probably, but the festival circuit is where, you know, we'll that's where you try and put it. So if you happen to live in a city like, I don't know, New York, where there's the New York Independent Film Video, well, if it gets into that, then that would be where you would see it on a big screen in New York. So, you know, we'll see how it goes. But the website, if folks are interested in the Arch Debunkers movie, is Leda Calder, LedaCalder.com. And you can, you know, that's where all the information about that film would be found.
All right, awesome. Well, thanks again, Paul, and we'll talk to you again sometime soon.
Thanks, Soraya. It's always a pleasure talking to you, and some of what I said was tongue-in-cheek, so don't take it personally, folks.
Come in. Do you read me? Do you understand the numbers pouring over your connection? To perfection. 5-8-3. Have you heard the singing soaking into our transmission? 21, 34, 55, 89. Whence came this dream that bugs my mind? Behind a curtain, outside of time. Can you hear the ballet plays, the whirring of the world? Can you hear the ballet plays, the whirring of the world? Can you hear the into the heart of the universe. Ventricles and atriate, chambers number 1597. And counting. And counting. Can you hear?